everyone. We're going to be wrapping up John chapter 9 this morning and jumping into John chapter 10. I'd like to turn your Bibles there. I just wanted to do some takeaways from John chapter 9. Again, this is the story of Jesus healing the blind man. It is the sixth of the seven major signs. There it is. And it's a very simple story. There's not much extra teaching that's happening here. Jesus doesn't really go on a large discourse after this happens. A lot of the conversation that takes place is a direct result of this miracle. But again, it's a very simple story. But the back and forth that happens between the blind man and the Pharisees, and then Jesus and the Pharisees, I just think has so much in it. It's very deep, these simple stories. And I just love this guy, this nameless blind man, because he just speaks simple truth. He doesn't mix words. It's kind of like Jesus said about Nathanael. Here is a man in whom is no guile. He's not going to shy away from the truth. So just kind of some takeaways from this story. First of all, the man says, who has ever heard of a blind man being healed? He says a man blind from birth. And certainly there aren't any Old Testament stories or anything about this. But we do have some Old Testament precedent for this happening. Really, in many of Jesus' miracles, we have some sort of Old Testament reference that can be applied that proves that Jesus is the Messiah based on what the Old Testament had to say. But first of all, just starting out with Exodus chapter 4, you recall that this is when God is speaking to Moses and giving him the charge to go into Egypt and speak to Pharaoh and to the people. And Moses says, I'm not an eloquent man. You need to choose someone else. And God comes back to him and says, who made the human mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, the reason I put that up there is because we had this initial question by the disciples about who sinned. Was it this man or was it his parents? As if this man caused his blindness, or his parents caused this blindness. God creates us all. Now, some of us are born in different ways than others. It's just the way we are. But the fact remains, God created us all. And so we are all under His charge, and He has authority over all of us, and over all the things that may be affecting us. And so in Psalm 146, in verse 8, we read there that the Lord opens the eyes of the blind, the Lord raises up the oppressed, and the Lord loves the righteous. Okay, so again, he says, who's ever heard of a man being healed that's been born blind? And yet, Psalm 146, I'm assuming that's David writing that psalm, speaks and says, the Lord opens the eyes of the blind. Now, that may be in a spiritual sense, but nonetheless, the precedent is there. And I just think it's interesting that right after that is, the Lord raises up the oppressed and the Lord loves the righteous. And isn't that what we see in this story? This man is being oppressed by the religious leadership at the time. And he expresses his righteousness. And so the last person to speak to this man is Jesus, who sought him out after he had been thrown out of the temple by the Pharisees. And then Isaiah 35, as he's prophesying, and this specifically is a prophecy of Israel being restored under the divine king. And he says, I will strengthen the weak hands, steady the shaking knees. Say to the faint-hearted, be strong and do not fear. Here is your God. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. And so again, this is another thing that we could take on multiple levels. We could take this on a literal level in that Jesus is doing this very thing, and on a spiritual level in that He is coming to those who are spiritually blind and are opening their eyes. So you think maybe, for instance, of Nicodemus in that particular case. Nicodemus had kind of a shroud over his perception, and Jesus opened his eyes to the spiritual realities around him. So this is not without Old Testament precedent. And then there's really a major theme running all through this chapter of seeing and blindness, and then night and day. And we've already talked about how in John's writings, both in the gospel and in his letters, that light and darkness are big themes that John is getting across. We read especially in John chapter 1 about Jesus being the true light that comes into the world and shines through the darkness. So just major themes from this. Another major theme, and this is one thing that we're going to, well, we've already seen it, but we're going to touch on more this morning, that someone who does not want to hear the gospel is not going to hear the gospel. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't preach it. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't go to those people. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't remind them from time to time. But there are just going to be people who are not going to listen. It is a statement of fact. It's a sad statement, but it is what it is. And so, in this chapter particularly, I think, you know, verse 27, they've been asking this blind man, or this recently healed blind man, over and over again about who healed you, how did he do it? And he says, I already told you, but you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? And then Jesus is going to say the same thing in chapter 10 this morning, when they ask him, are you the Messiah? Tell us plainly. And he's going to say, I did tell you, and you didn't believe, or you didn't listen. They don't want to hear the answer. They just want him to give the answer so that they have some way to persecute him. So someone who doesn't want to hear is not going to hear. But one thing that I think is very interesting about this is the blind man's story, if you really look at it, it parallels Jesus' story. Maybe think about this. First of all, his identity is debated, even though he clearly states it, or there are clear signs of who he is. So you recall early in John chapter 9, right after he's healed, the people are looking at him and saying, well, was this the blind man? Was this the guy that's been begging? And some said, well, yeah, it looks like him. And the other people said, no, that's crazy talk. And the blind man is saying, it is me. Yes, it's me. And so as the story goes along, we have him going to the Pharisees, and they debate this. They debate whether or not he was even born blind. Then they bring in his parents and say, is this your son? So even though the signs are clear, it's debated. Same thing with Jesus. Jesus comes onto the scene. It's debated whether or not he is who he says he is. And in that debate, the Jews don't believe him despite the clear signs. In this blind man's case, his blindness is obviously gone. He can see where he could not before. And he'll state that very thing. It's a clear sign. And then Jesus obviously displays clear signs as well through the miracles. And then in that disbelief, the Jews reject him despite the fact that he's innocent. They have no reason to throw him out of the temple. They think that Jesus is a blasphemer and he's Jesus' disciple and all these types of things, but he's innocent. And so they charge him with something that he's not guilty of and throw him out. Of course, they do the same to Jesus. But yet he continues to speak truth in the face of persecution. They were obviously looking for ways to throw people out of the temple. We see his parents fear at confessing that he is who he says he is. And so they said, well, he's of age, just ask him. So they kind of deferred the answer back to him. And it says the reason was because of their fear of being cast out of the temple. And we talked about that a little bit last time, that being cast out also means that they are cut off. It's not just that they can't go in the temple and worship, it's that they're cut off from their people. But yet, this man, despite that happening to him, continues to speak the truth with these people in his face asking him this question over and over again. And just like Jesus, the Jews reject him despite the fact that he spoke the truth. And then lastly, and this slightly applicable to Jesus, but he is sought out and accepted by the Lord. And maybe another way to kind of term that in a much shorter version, he is blessed by the Lord. Because that's what blessing is, isn't it? It's approval from God. And so this man is sought out by Jesus, and he's allowed to confess to Jesus that he is the Son of God. And we see his faith and belief as a result of that. So, again, just some takeaways from this. Any thoughts? Yes. His parents sold him out. Yes. Fear is a funny thing. It does strange things to people. I don't know. Yes, Mark.
I'm intrigued by the very last verse in this chapter.
Uh-huh.
And Jesus uses paradoxes so much in his teaching. And the idea that if I am going to see, I need to make myself blind. Mm-hmm. Blind to speculation. Blind to my own interest.
Right. Right. Well, it's the whole in the world but not of the world concept, right? You know, it's not just living apart. It's living apart with a view towards something else, something higher. And so in a way, we have to, you know, kind of like a horse in a cart, we have to put on blinders and seek what's straight ahead of us. So, yes. And that's really going to be the chapter 10 is really a continuation of that thought. So that's definitely going to be a good point. Anything else on chapter 9? Okay. Let's go on into chapter 10 then. And we'll pick up here reading verses 1 through 6. I assure you, anyone who doesn't enter the sheep pen by the door, but climbs in some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. The doorkeeper opens it for him, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought all his own outside, he goes ahead of them. The sheep follow him because they recognize his voice. They will never follow a stranger. Instead, they will run away from him because they don't recognize the voice of strangers. Jesus gave them this illustration, but they did not understand what he was telling them. Okay, so just starting out here, first of all, verse 1 here. Again, this is a continuation of the previous thought. And I think the chapter break here is because of the kind of shift in topic. But they are related thoughts. So verse 41, if you were blind, of chapter 9, if you were blind, you wouldn't have sin. But now that you say, we see, your sin remains. So Jesus making two types of people here, those who do see and those who don't see. And so he's going to elaborate on these. And so kind of like we just said, it's almost like a livestock or an animal following after its master. So we have this sheep analogy that comes in and the shepherd. But he starts this out in the negative. And he says, anyone who doesn't enter the sheep pen by the door but climbs in some other way is a thief and a robber. Now think about your own house. You got somebody at your house and your neighbor's kind of looking at your house. And they see somebody climbing in the window as opposed to walking in the door. What do you think their first thought is? They're a robber. Something fishy is going on. Unless I come back out the front door and assure them that it was me and I just locked my key inside, then they know something's up. Because nobody's going to come in through the window. That's crazy. And that's really what Jesus is saying. But this idea of thieves and robbers, again, whenever Jesus uses terminology or he's giving one of these analogies, I always think it's helpful to go back to the Old Testament and see maybe if these images have been used in other places. Because a lot of times he is referring back to ideas like this. And I think Hosea chapter 6 talks about this. And Zechariah chapter 5, I think, also is a great... Zechariah 5, verses 1 through 4. This is Zechariah's night visions, we term them. And one of the things that God shows Zechariah in that vision in Zechariah 5, it says, "I looked up again and saw a flying scroll. 'What do you see?' he asked me. 'I see a flying scroll,' I replied, 30 feet long and 15 feet wide. And then he said to me, 'This is the curse that is going out over the whole land. For every thief will be removed according to what is written on one side, and everyone who swears falsely will be removed according to what is written on the other side. I will send it out, the declaration of the Lord. And it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name. And it will stay inside his house and destroy it along with its timbers and stones." Okay, so what Jesus is doing here then is he's saying, again, two types of people. There are those who are supposed to be here, and there are those who are operating according to illicit intentions. And the Old Testament is very clear about how it feels about thieves, and God says, "I'm going to go throughout the land and root out thieves and remove them." And Jesus says then, anyone who does not enter by the sheep pen, and he's going to elaborate on this, by the sheep pen is a thief and a robber. So now the obvious question from the audience is, okay, so who's the thief and the robber? Which one of us is the thief and the robber? But the one who enters by the door, verse 2, is the shepherd of the sheep. The doorkeeper opens it for him, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. So now we're getting more into the idea of the shepherd and the sheep. And this is a beautiful analogy. We don't have any parables in John, but this is probably one of the closest things we get. It's an allegory that Jesus is giving. And this shepherd, he starts out, the very first thing he says about the shepherd is that he has a relationship with the sheep. That the sheep know him so well and are so familiar with him that all he has to do is call them by name and they follow. I can't get my dog to follow me half the time when I yell out his name. But this shepherd knows each sheep in his flock. And we've already seen Jesus in other Gospels talk about the flock. I mean, granted, this was another allegory, but he says, which of the shepherd who has 100 sheep and loses one? Now, if we're using that shepherd in this example, that's 100 sheep that he individually knows their name, their characteristics, and we can kind of infer from that he also knows every detail about them. Which one was dealing with hoof rot two weeks ago? Which one is due for shearing? Which one needs to be culled from the herd, because it's the appropriate season? All these things. He knows the sheep intimately, and they know him and trust him. But I also think it's interesting that it says that he leads them out. Now, of course, a shepherd would be leading his sheep. But, we think of kind of herdsmen, and I think kind of cattle herding. You kind of have to get behind them and get them out. That's why Jesus was using the whip in the temple, right? He was getting all the livestock out. He has to get behind them and push them where they go. No, in this analogy, he's going in front of them and they are seeking him out to follow him. And I can't help but think when it says he leads them out, I can't help but think of maybe wilderness analogy of the children of Israel in the wilderness. What did God do for the children of Israel in the wilderness? Let me ask this. What had he just done in terms of Egypt? He led them out. Exactly. And then as he leads them out, where is he in relation to them? He's ahead of them. He's leading them. And the Old Testament even talked about that. Exodus 13, it's reflected on in Psalm 77. Talks about the Lord leading his people in the pillar through the wilderness. But I think in this shepherd analogy, in this particular analogy, the shepherd is among the sheep in a very physical sense. So anywhere the shepherd goes, he's not going to lead them anywhere he's not willing to go himself. And that's the thing. That's one of the strengths that we see in David, right? That he's willing to fight bears, he's willing to fight lions on behalf of his sheep. He's not willing to take them anywhere. He's not willing to go himself. And Jesus is not going to do that either. But again, the shepherd has the type of relationship with his sheep such that he doesn't have to strong arm them into following him. Now, how does that relate to the previous chapter, to the events we saw with the blind man? What was happening with the Pharisees? What were the parents afraid of? They were afraid of persecution. They were afraid of being cast out, of being strong-armed into... That's what they were doing. They were holding the threat of excommunication over the heads of the people to get them to fall in line. That's what's happening. But in terms of the shepherd, he's not strong-arming people. He is calling them to him, and they are following him willingly. So a very sharp contrast in method here. They know his voice and they trust him to lead. And then he goes on in that analogy. They will never follow a stranger. Instead, they'll run away from him because they don't recognize the voice of strangers. So these sheep are now so trusting of the master that anyone else who calls out to them, they won't follow. Now think in terms of kind of modern day religion. We're called in 50 different directions on a daily basis. We have this person preaching this truth. We have this person teaching this philosophy and all these things. We have all these people calling out to us, and it's often tempting to say, well, yeah, that sounds good. That sounds great. But here it says, the sheep don't recognize those other voices. They're only following the voice of the shepherd. And again, these are very simple thoughts, but the meaning is profound. That we need to be so engrossed in the voice of the master and so looking to hear him that we can't hear anything else. Now the world might call that bigotry. The world might say that we're closed-minded. But you know what? Jesus is calling us to be closed-minded to some things. Simple truth. I think about when I read that, I immediately thought of, you know, when you teach your kids stranger danger. You know, if you're in a crowd, they'll listen for your voice to call out to them. But if somebody else speaks to them, they might shy away from them. Because you've taught them to not trust someone else unless they know that person. But they know you and they know your voice and they seek you out. But again, verse 6, they did not understand. If we're going to use this terminology, they aren't able to recognize the shepherd's voice and hear what he's saying to them. So Jesus then continues on. He explains this further. Verse 7, Jesus said again, I assure you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep didn't listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture. A thief comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come so that they may have life and have it in abundance. So now this is one of those I am statements in John. There are two of them in this chapter. So first of all, he says, I am the door of the sheep. Now kind of going back to Middle Eastern shepherd practices in this time, and I had to read up about this. But the shepherd brings the sheep back to the pen. And as he does so, he puts himself in the doorway of the pen. So the sheep have to go through him to get back in. And as they're doing that, he's inspecting each one to be sure that it's his and to be sure that there's nothing wrong with them. So he's making sure that everything is good. And they, again, have to go through him. He permits them to come through. And that's the only way to get back into the safety of the pen where nothing can harm them. So Jesus says then, I am the door of the sheep. He effectively becomes the door through which they have to enter. All who came before me are thieves and robbers. So there's that image again. Now, this may refer to false messiahs who preceded Jesus. There were many who came claiming to be the Messiah. They were obviously proven false, and many of those were put down by either the Greeks or the Romans. And really, this is going to be a future threat as well that Jesus talks about to them in Matthew 24 when he talks about false messiahs are going to come and claim that they are not who they say they are. Or it's possibly a reference to the religious leaders who intimidate and lord their position over the people, that these people are the thieves and the robbers. So Jesus then kind of pointing and making that connection to them. But notice the contrast here. A thief comes to steal and to kill and to destroy. Now contrast that with the previous verse. What does it say that Jesus as the door is going to do in verse 9? That they will be saved. I heard it over here. That they will be saved and come in and go out and find pasture. That not only will they be saved, that they will be provided for. That's what the pasture is about. It's the providence of God. So, you know, you contrast that. He's going to be giving them something. Actually, if you want to think about it, he's going to be giving them everything. But the thief and the robber come to take and to destroy. So then Jesus continues along, verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired man, since he is not the shepherd and doesn't own the sheep, leaves them and runs away when he sees a wolf coming. The wolf then snatches and scatters them. This happens because he is a hired man and doesn't care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own sheep and they know me, as the Father knows me and I know the Father. I lay down my life for the sheep, but I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. There will be one flock, one shepherd. Okay, so Jesus now goes full bore into this analogy. I am the good shepherd. So this is the next of the I am statements in John. Turn very quickly over to Ezekiel chapter 34. Ezekiel 34. Again, when looking at these the images that Jesus gives us, especially when he makes these proclamations of either who he is or how he operates, look for Old Testament precedents. Look to see if there may be some either previous mention or analogy to it in the Old Testament somewhere. Your center reference will be very good for that particular, if you've got that in your Bible. But in Ezekiel chapter 34... I believe Jesus is referring heavily to this particular chapter. And God, in speaking to Ezekiel, picking up in verse 1, it says, "The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel." Now, who's he talking about there? Who are the shepherds of Israel in this case? What's that? Well, the people... If we're thinking about them in terms of a flock, let's say that the people are the sheep. So then who are the shepherds in Israel? It's the priesthood, right? It's the priest. It's the leadership. That's right. You know, you think many other places in the major and minor prophets. It's the priests who are called out. I think of Jeremiah specifically. Jeremiah speaks out heavily against the priesthood in that particular book. But God speaking here, "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the Lord God says to the shepherds. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who have been feeding themselves. Shouldn't the shepherds feed their flock? You eat the fat, wear the wool, and butcher the fatlings, but you do not tend the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bandaged the injured, brought back the strays, or sought the lost. Instead, you have ruled them with violence and cruelty. They were scattered for lack of a shepherd. They became food for all the wild animals when they were scattered. My flock went astray on all the mountains and every high hill. They were scattered over the whole face of the earth, and there was no one searching or seeking for them." That's heavy judgment talk right there. That God is telling the priesthood and the religious leaders of Israel that they have failed in every aspect of what they're supposed to be doing. Not only have they failed, they have reveled in their failure. They are eating the best, they are taking from everyone, and they are ruling with violence and cruelty. Can we apply that to what's happening in Jesus' time? Certainly we can. So Jesus, using this analogy of the good shepherd, that means there's a contrast between the good shepherd and what? The bad shepherds, right? And that's the contrast that God's making to Ezekiel here. So he continues on in that indictment. But look down at verse 20, Ezekiel 34, 20. Therefore, this is what the Lord God says to them. The fat sheep and, see, I myself will judge between the fat sheep and the lean sheep. Since you have pushed with flank and shoulder and butted all the weak ones with your horns until you scattered them all over, I will save my flock, and they will no longer be prey for you. I will judge between one sheep and another. I will appoint over them a single shepherd, my servant David, and he will shepherd them. He will tend them himself and will be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Now, at the time that Ezekiel is prophesying, this is around the time of Daniel, has David already died? That's a resounding yes. David died a long time before this. Long, long time before this. So who's he talking about? My servant David. He's talking about Jesus, right? He's talking about the Messiah. This is Messiah language. And he likens this person to a shepherd. Now think back. It wasn't in John, but we did mention it when we talked about it. The feeding of the 5,000. Jesus comes out to the hillside and he sees the people coming to him. And it says that he had compassion on them. How does he describe the people that are coming? Do you remember? They are like sheep without a shepherd. Exactly. It's not just that they don't have anyone to follow. It's that their leaders have failed them and not taught them the truth. And it's the same indictment that Ezekiel is making against the people here. And so when Jesus talks about thieves and robbers, he's saying the exact same thing that he said about that God said about the priesthood in Ezekiel 34. That they're stealing from the people. They're stealing from God, really. So when we look at this image of the good shepherd, again, they should have some knowledge of this. It should evoke some imagery in their head because they're familiar with the Old Testament. If these are the Pharisees, they are quite familiar with the Old Testament. So Jesus then, again, he's drawing a lot of contrast in this particular chapter. And he says, the hired man, since he is not the shepherd and doesn't own the sheep, leaves them and runs away when he sees a wolf coming. So on one hand, we have this person that comes to steal and take away and to kill. That's an external threat. But now we're going internal. The hired man is not the thief. He's the person that the shepherd entrusted with the care of the sheep. But what's the difference between the shepherd and the hired man? He's the shepherd, right? Right. So he's got skin in the game, right? The hired man, he's just getting paid. He can go find another job. But he's not going to put his life at risk. That's the main point that he's making. You aren't truly invested in these sheep like I am. You don't have a relationship with them. You're just someone who's here for what you can get. And the minute you see a threat coming, you're hightailing it out. And Jesus says, the good shepherd is not like that. The hired man is only concerned with his own safety. Now, consider this. Maybe apply this. We're going to be jumping forward to John 11 here. But maybe apply this to the attitude that's on display in John 11, 48. Remember, after Lazarus is raised here, the Jews go back to the Pharisees and tell them about everything that's happened with Lazarus. And they say that, verse 47, what are we going to do since this man does many signs? But then verse 48 of chapter 11, we see their motivation. If we let him continue in this way, everybody will believe in him. Then the Romans will come and remove both our place and our nation. What was their motivation? Prestige, position, right? It's what they can get. If we let this man continue in the way that he is and everybody believes in him as they're supposed to, we're out. Our place is done. But isn't it funny that that's what Jesus came teaching? All these positions and all these semblances of power and authority and lording it over people, that these need to be gotten rid of anyways. So I just think it's interesting that he's definitely pointing to the Pharisees, whether they're immediately seeing it or not. I really think that they're starting to get the picture. But again, as a result, the people have become sheep without a shepherd. And if we look at maybe, for instance, the writings of Peter in 1 Peter, Peter is going to warn the elders of the church against this type of attitude. Don't be an elder or a leader in the church because you can get something out of it. Don't seek after the things that you can get. Become an elder, become a leader so that you can be an example to the flock. Not for your own prestige, but to lead them to Jesus. And so then Jesus makes this personal to himself. I know the sheep and they know me. Now that word know there is one that we've already seen. In chapter 1, remember it says that he came into the world, but the world did not recognize him. That word recognize is the same word know. It's that the Greek word genosko. And it implies a familiarity that is gained through relationship. It's not just academic knowledge. It's knowledge gained because you sought it out in someone and you wanted to get to know them or whatever the thing was. And so then in that vein, I know I have a relationship with and recognize my sheep. And then they recognize me. It's a reciprocal relationship. But notice how he characterizes this. He modifies this and gets much more specific about it. As the Father knows me. Now, how well does the Father know Jesus? Pretty well, we can assume. Why? Because I and the Father are one, he's going to say, right? We are the same. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay? So he says then, as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and that's a closer relationship than anything. Jesus says, I know my sheep. Now that should be a comforting thought to us. I know my sheep. So Jesus seeks us out. He recognizes us and wants to have that relationship with us. And again, that's the concept behind being blessed. So when Jesus is giving the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, and he talks about, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, and so on and so forth. That's what he's talking about. The Father wants to have a relationship with these people because of the type of people that they are. And then he will reward them based on that. He will meet their needs and provide for them. But then he finishes this particular section by saying, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also and they will listen to my voice. Who do you think these other sheep are? Who's he talking about? It's possibly talking about the Gentiles, right? So, Jesus came not just to save the Jews. He came to save everyone. We've already seen him talk to people that are outside of the traditional Jewish fold. And he says that this was always meant to be, and we'll see this carried out to a much larger degree in Acts. anything else on this particular section, Mark?
Well, I couldn't help but notice when we were in Ezekiel, there in chapter 34 and verse 22, he says, I will judge. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes.
what he's doing is calling the Pharisees out.
That's right. That's right. Well, and they've judged themselves. We talked about this in previous classes, that this is a self-judgment, that they're not living according to the law that, A, they're proclaiming, or and B, that God meant them to. Okay, continue. Verse 17. We're going to run out of time here. This is why the Father loves me, because I'm laying down my life so that I may take it up again. So again, contrasting with the hired man who was not willing to put himself in harm's way. As soon as he sees the threat coming from afar off, he runs off. Jesus says the shepherd, the good shepherd, lays down his life for the sheep. He's going to be there for them to the very end on their behalf. And that word for, it's just a small preposition, but it has a whole lot of weight to it, because the word is hyper. We use that word today, hyper. It means to lift up or to raise up. So I lay down my life so that I may raise them up for them. But he also says, I'm laying down my life so I may take it up again. Now, this is an interesting part of this, because Jesus has talked about sacrifice. He's talked about self-sacrifice and what he came to do, that he was going to be lifted up in the sight of man, and based on their faith, they would be saved and be granted eternal life. But there's two parts to this, aren't there? We can't have this and remember this without what came after this, and that is the resurrection. And Jesus says, the Father gave me a mission, and my mission is to die for the people. But the second half of that is to also be raised up for the people. Now, in terms of what he's saying here, the Father prepared him for that mission by giving him the authority to do that. He has the authority to die, and he has the authority to raise himself up again. And that's what the next chapter is going to be all about. Jesus has authority over life and death. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own. His life, he's talking about. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down on my own. I have the right to take it up again. I have received this command from my Father. Jesus is in control. We've talked about this. This is the final months of Jesus' earthly life. He's about to go to the Feast of Dedication. That's Hanukkah. So we're in December. Same time. We're in December. He's going to be killed sometime in probably March or April. So we're in the last month of his life. Events are really ramping up for him to die. And we're going to see here, he's almost going to be stoned twice. But they're going to be unsuccessful in that, because Jesus is in control. His hour had not yet come. And that's what he says. No one takes it from me. And so verse 19, and this is that Ezekiel imagery coming in again. Again, a division took place among the Jews because of these words. Now remember back in Ezekiel, God said, I'm going to separate the fat rams from the lean rams. That there's going to be a division between these. Now, we could take that in one sense and say that God's actually going to come in and physically separate these people. But His Word is what separates them, what creates that dividing line. And that's what happens. A division takes place. Many of them were saying, he has a demon and he's crazy. Why do you listen to him? And others were saying, these are not the words of someone who's demon-possessed. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? So they're appealing back to the miracle from the last chapter. We're going to have to pick this up next class. verse 22. Jesus comes to the festival of dedication. It takes place again. That's Hanukkah. It's the celebration of the Maccabean revolt about 200 years prior to this. And it says, verse 24, the Jews surrounded him. I think that's an interesting way to characterize this. Certainly they're coming and finding him and getting in his face. But the fact that Jesus just likened external threats to wolves, I think is interesting for John to characterize it this way. The Jews surround him and ask, how long are you going to keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us plainly. Jesus responds, I did tell you and you didn't believe. The works that I do in my Father's name testify about me, but you do not believe because you are not my sheep. So even if this is a separate occasion, Jesus is referring back to this previous discourse in the early part of the chapter. You are not my sheep. You don't hear my voice. You are not of my Father. I give my sheep, verse 28, I give them eternal life and they will never perish, ever. No one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. No one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. So just as Jesus has the authority to lay down his life and to take it up again, he has the authority to call these sheep to him and prevent all outside threats from removing them. They cannot be taken away from him. And John's going to make this point heavily in 1 John. If you have the love of the Father, you cannot be taken out of that love. You can take yourself out of that love. Let's be very clear about that. But someone cannot come along and take you. And then this statement, the Father and I are one. He has the authority. He granted me the authority. We are one in essence and in purpose. The Father and I are one. And we see their reaction. The Jews pick up rocks to stone him. And that's the prescribed method of death in Leviticus 24 for blasphemy. And that's what they say. Jesus says, for what good works are you stoning me? We aren't stoning you for a good work, they said, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God. And I just think that that's an ironic statement. You are a man who make yourself God. Didn't Jesus do exactly the opposite of that? Philippians chapter 2. He was a God who made himself man, even though he was still God. So it's just kind of ironic. We're gonna pick up in verse 34 next class. I want to delve into this particular section a little bit. I apologize for going over time here, but this part was kind of confusing to me, where Jesus says, "Isn't it written in your scriptures? I said you are gods." What does that mean? What are the implications? What is Jesus trying to get across there? So we'll pick up in verse 34 of chapter 10 next time and then jump into chapter 11. Any final thoughts before the bell rings? Okay. Thank you very much.